You're listening to Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Let's head out to Echo Park Lake, where it's mostly quiet on a recent afternoon, aside from flocks of geese fighting over breadcrumbs. There's at most a few dozen people inside the park, including 74-year-old Dino Aguayo.
I know this park for 60 years, brother. I've been living, I live at 2 blocks from right here. There's been a lot of changing from right here. But since the homeless are not here, they better, brother. You know, you don't see that much crap. You don't see not too many robberies and nothing, brother. That's cool. You know, I like it that way.
Changes, Aguayo says, because exactly 1 year ago, the city of L.A. closed this park and evicted a massive homeless encampment community. The displacement was met by protests, and those protests were met by hundreds of LAPD officers who shut down the neighborhood and arrested scores of demonstrators, even journalists. Work crews installed a chain-link fence to keep the campers out. The consequences of this divisive police raid have been both personal and far-reaching. Where did the 200 homeless people living in the park end up? How many of them got help? And how did the debacle at Echo Park Lake change the way city leaders approach the issue of homelessness? Reporter Aaron Schrank has some answers.
So let's start with the people who were kicked out of the park. They were offered temporary shelter before the cops moved in last year, and 178 of them accepted, according to the LA Homeless Services Authority, or LHASA. Over the past year, more than half of those people left their programs, mostly returning to the street. Today, 79 remain in temporary shelter, like government-funded hotel stays. And a year after the Echo Park Lake closure, LHASA says just 9 former residents have been placed into permanent housing. Will Sens hopes to be number 10. He'd been camping at the park with his girlfriend for several months when they were offered a room in the LA Grand Hotel downtown. I met him in a noisy food court near the hotel.
We weren't sure what it was going to be like at first, so we left our stuff standing there for a night. And we went to the hotel. We didn't know where we were going. We didn't know anything about it. They just told us that, like, in a year, we would have a place.
Sens says he was one of the first Echo Park campers to move to the Grand, but a lot more showed up right before the brutal shutdown.
How Hollywood was that? Just total overkill. Come on, man. Just trying to make a scene, like, and they did. They scared a lot of people.
LA City Councilman Mitch O'Farrell, who represents Echo Park, described the effort in a tweet last year as one of the most successful housing operations in LA history. But only a small fraction of the people he promised to help are inside long-term housing today. O'Farrell declined an interview for this story and did not comment on the number of people housed. At a similar effort last summer on the Venice Beach boardwalk, the numbers were much better. Of the more than 200 people initially moved indoors, 82 are in permanent housing today, according to homeless services provider the St. Joseph Center. Sens is still waiting for a permanent place to live. He says he feels lucky to share a hotel room with his girlfriend. He's seen isolation take a toll on some of his fellow tenants.
People that are alone, it's really hard for them, like really hard. I can't imagine if I had a drug or alcohol problem and I was there.
The program at the Grand is run by the Salvation Army. Sens and others tell me there's a constant tension between residents and staff, who enforce curfews and control access to the rooms.
When you don't have control of your actions and your body, you don't have your agency in your own space, that is carceral, and you're being punished for being poor.
Sens says the conditions inside Project Roomkey are inhumane, which is the same argument Councilman Mitch O'Farrell made about the Echo Park encampment. O'Farrell, who was up for re-election this year, points to 4 deaths in the park in 2020 as evidence of poor safety conditions there. But where some saw danger and squalor, many unhoused Angelenos found an oasis from the harsh realities of life on the street. David Bush Lilly has been homeless since the 90s, sleeping on sidewalks on LA's west side and advocating for others like him. After the pandemic hit, he moved to the encampment and found a supportive community of homeless people working together to cook meals, build showers, even create a jobs program.
And we saw how really a beautiful thing it was happening here. I mean, we spent all of this money trying to help homeless people deal with their mental trauma. And the park setting was one of the most healing things that so many homeless people found here. It's a form of mental health treatment, a very cost-effective one.
But as LA homeless encampments grew during the pandemic, in part because of CDC guidelines prohibiting sweeps, public pressure to do something about the camps also grew. Echo Park wasn't the first time local leaders flooded a specific geographic location with offers of temporary shelter. But for better or worse, the controversial action charted a clear course for local leaders. The approach has since been replicated to clear encampments in Venice Beach, MacArthur Park, and just last week, Little Tokyo. And LA's recent update to its anti-camping ordinance means there's more to come. LA City Councilman Mike Bonin represents Venice and oversaw the boardwalk effort last summer. He says he learned a thing or two from Echo Park.
Anytime you do something big in government, you look at what has been done before. And there were things about Echo Park where we learned and said, well, we ain't going to do this. I mean, before we did Venice in my district, I told my staff, in so many ways, we need to do the opposite of what they did there.
Bonin says that meant fewer cops, no fencing, more intensive outreach to the unhoused, and more notice and transparency to the community at large. He says he also tried to be clear about the goal of the effort and how to measure its success or failure.
There were a lot of people in Venice who were saying, clear the beach, clear the beach, clear the beach. And I said, listen, we're going to go in and we're going to try to get everybody indoors and offer them a housing resource. The consequence of that will be the beach will be clear. I wanted the beach being clear to be the consequence, not the aim.
While Bonin's boardwalk effort avoided Echo Park Lake level controversy, many of the progressive councilman's approaches to homelessness have provoked his West Side constituents. His proposal last year to consider a handful of parks and beach parking lots as sites for sanctioned campgrounds drew fierce opposition and fueled a failed recall effort against him. At Echo Park Lake, many visitors I meet tell me they aren't terribly concerned about where the homeless ended up. Mark Fagan says he's just happy to have a safer, cleaner park.
We actually stopped coming here for a long time because of the social decay. You know, the pollution, the environmental pollution here was grave. And I see a gigantic difference now that there's a zero tolerance for camping and a zero tolerance for homeless living here. Definitely improved. We come back a lot more often.
For some, it's more nuanced. Shane Stoltz lives across the street from the park and says he's here almost every day.
I do have a lot of mixed feelings about it. One thing that's like really bothers me is the fence.
Stoltz is talking about the chain link fence that encloses the park. Mitch O'Farrell put it up last year and kept the park closed for a couple of months while the city did more than $1 million in repairs, including reseeding grass, disposing of waste, and installing security cameras. But today, the fence is still here, with 4 access gates allowing visitors to come and go.
Like, I get it when you guys were, like, making the changes, like, you needed to clean up, you need people to stay out for a second, but as soon as that happened, the fences should have came down.
For David Bush Lilly, it's a stark reminder of what took place here a year ago.
It's a very graphic symbol of the way we're fencing our minds off from looking at the deep issues that we have on one side of the fence, this nice little paradise that we're trying to artificially prop up. And on the outside of it, we have a community that's increasingly fearful of becoming homeless and ending up on the sidewalk.
Because of the fence, Echo Park Neighborhood Council member Dave Hunter says the park just isn't the community space it once was.
You know, I think people can see that this fence has a lot to do with not just displacing unhoused people, but also gentrification, displacing vendors. You know, they're not in there anymore. We always ask, when is the fence coming down? What are you doing to find out what the community really thinks? And, you know, there is no plan to, like, actually, like, poll the community. There has been nothing yet, and it's been a year.
Councilman O'Farrell declined to answer questions about how long the fence will stay. And so it remains indefinitely, along with deep community concerns and divisions over what happened here. For KCRW, I'm Aaron Schrank.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed, Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. If the national reckoning about race has taught us anything, it's that stories, real or even fictional, can help close the distance between communities. Those communities might be white and black, but can also be black and black.
You know, I don't even know what you're insinuating.
I know, and that's the main reason I'm here. I'm going to help you figure it out.
Figure out what?
Figure out what you lost.
I haven't lost anything.
Yeah, you have, which is why I sat down over the weekend and I wrote this.
What is this?
I've entitled it Being Black for Dummies.
Now that's the title of the play with the heading Hooded, which is a funny and at times dark performance about a couple of black teenagers. One raised by a single mom in Baltimore's inner city, and the other raised in an affluent white suburb of the town of Achievement Heights.
You don't know who Harriet Tubman is? Don't you remember anything from Black History Month? You mean those trivia cards in civics class? Partly. She that woman who, like, couldn't find a seat on the bus or something?
That's Rosa Parks.
Thank you, Prairie.
Harriet Tubman owned a railroad.
No, she didn't own a railroad.
Yeah. Hooded, or Being Black for Dummies, is being produced by the Echo Theater Company. You can see it now through about mid-April, about a month from now, April 18th, at the Atwater Village Theater. And we have a couple of folks from the play with us right now. Brent Grimes plays the character True. He's the one who writes Being Black for Dummies for his friend. Brent, welcome to you.
Hello, Steve.
Thanks for coming on.
No problem. It's my pleasure.
Ahmed Best is director of the play. Ahmed, welcome to you as well.
Thank you, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here.
Brent, I want to start with you. Your character, True, is sort of, you know, he's the interloper, right, in the play. He disturbs the comfortable. And, you know, the achievement-oriented path Marquise is on, you know, Marquise talks about Princeton and just like his adopted parents, his adopted white parents, law school. What attracted you to playing that character?
I've always known a True throughout my whole life. I feel like I knew the character very well. This past couple years, you know, there's been a lot of conversation around race, and I've had very strong opinions on what I feel like, what America's doing or not doing, and I feel like, you know, I struggle with this a lot sometimes, feeling like, you know, where is my voice in all of this and what can I do to sort of make an impact? And I feel like the stage was sort of, you know, is sort of my medium. And this play was just a, you know, beautifully written piece that I just felt like needed to be, you know, the story needed to be told. So, yeah.
Ahmed, what is the story that needs to be told? We're talking about a lot of cliches that are in this. We're talking about a lot of people who have the wrong sort of sense of what's going on. Is that sort of where we are?
Yeah, thanks for the question. I think what happens a lot is we see these young people, specifically young black men in the context of this play, and we see them being murdered on social media, we see them being murdered on the news, and we talk about how sad it is, and we are hyper-focused on that event. And what we don't know is who they are. We don't know their lives, and we don't find out about their lives until after they're gone. And if we realized outside of an artistic format, outside of this platform, if we realize that what we're doing is we're losing these people, we're losing potential heroes. You know, Trayvon Martin wanted to be an astronaut.
Trayvon Martin, of course, the 14-year-old who was gunned down by George Zimmerman in Florida, which...
Yeah, it's not just Trayvon. It was Trayvon Martin. It was Tamir Rice, who was 12. You know, it's Dante Wright. It's Mike Brown. There's this litany of people. And
these are all human beings with a history. Yeah.
With a story, with families, with people who love them. They're our sons. They're our brothers. They're our sisters. They're our best friends. And, you know, they get demonized on one side, canonized on the other, and they just want to live their lives. So Hooded is really about that. It's really about the life of Marquise and True entering into that life and this friendship being formed.
And True, your character, Brent, writes this Being Black for Dummies. This is a, you know, in a giant, what is it, a three-ring folder.
A big, thick binder, 200-plus pages.
Binder.
Yeah. And you're helping Marquise understand the black experience that he's been missing in the suburbs? And how many things are in there? It's numbered to like into the 200s, right?
Just about. Well, actually, no, maybe about, was it, Ahmed, maybe like 100 the last 200?
It's 114.
114.
Yeah. Yes.
As black people, as young black men, we walk around with this target on our back. And so what I think True offers is, you know, the other side of the black experience, where it's like, you know, Marquise may have had a more sheltered upbringing in, you know, good schools and in a good environment, whereas True hasn't necessarily been exposed to these things. And, you know, he may at times come across as a bit crass or unrefined, but where he lacks that, he makes up for it in his awareness and sort of, you know, his street savvy.
What was it like for you growing up? Did you, I mean, these issues, were you, you know, I mean, when you're talking about that sort of target that you mentioned earlier, was it there for you?
Oh, yeah, it was always there for me. I would say, you know, this play for me has been very cathartic. And I think, you know, and even though this play is about two young black boys, I think everybody in this play definitely has a very specific point of view on things, and they do have something to say, and that's everybody, the white people in the cast and men, women. I think it really gives the audience and everyone sort of a chance to examine, you know, how we relate to one another.
Ahmed, do you find the act of telling stories like this and directing this play, you know, therapeutic for you? Is it a responsibility? I mean, obviously it's a responsibility. Is it depressing to you to do something like this?
No, to be honest, I think this is our way out. When you feel for someone's experience, it changes you. It changes your outlook. It changes your mindset. And you listen better. And I think that's the power of storytelling. One of the reasons why I wanted to approach this story is because it uses satire and humor to move you into a space that really gets you when it gets serious. And, you know, as much as I love the satire and as much as I love the humor of it, I love how it is used to really drop you into the gravity of what we're talking about. And that affects you, you know, it moves you. And once you're moved, you can change your mind and you can grow from it. So I think telling these stories and telling diverse stories in general, that's our way into humanity. That's how we all come together.
It affected me. Powerful play. I took a buddy of mine with me, and we both just sat there after it was over for a few minutes asking ourselves, what did we just see? And it was, I got to tell you, I learned a lot, I felt a lot, and I want to thank you both for coming on and talking to us about it. Hooded or Being Black for Dummies, on stage at the Atwater Village Theater until April 18th. Actor Brent Grimes, who plays True, director Ahmed Best. Thanks to you both.
Thank you so much, Steve. Appreciate you.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW, Steve Chiatakis here. After a couple of long, and I mean long, pandemic years, cannabis consumption lounges are making their comeback in West Hollywood. The original Cannabis Cafe, or Lowell Cafe as it first was known, opened back in 2019, right before the COVID encounter. It was the nation's first cannabis consumption lounge, and we inhaled a lot of it when it first landed on the scene. Well, back then, WeHo was on track to open more lounges, but, well, you know what happened. Now there's a new batch of green lounges getting ready to open, and here to tell us more is Mona Holmes, reporter at Eater LA, a regular, of course, here at Greater LA. Hi, Mona.
Hi, Steve.
So first off, what are some of these new cannabis lounges coming to WeHo? When are they going to open?
Well, I am very interested in seeing what's going to happen in 2022 and 2023. There's a new one that is going to be opening any moment now called the Artistry on Santa Monica Boulevard near La Cienega. And it's got some interesting elements, a lot of art. It's a dispensary. It will also be a consumption lounge. So that's one. There's another one called Eon Botanica, which is leaning more towards the health and wellness side of things. The founder, Nicole Fox, she's a certified nutritionist and wants people to come into Eon and drink tea and be able to smoke or hang out while getting a health consultation, for example. And that one will open later in the year. Again, that one's in West Hollywood. And then there's also a place called The Antidote, but that's going to be opening at least in 2023, which will be right next door to the Troubadour. And it's going to be a two-story place where they'll have a smoking lounge, an edibles lounge, as well as a place called a Pure Bar. They've got this interesting solution towards things where they're going to pair a water-soluble dehydrated cannabis powder that they'll pair with mocktails in a non-smoking environment. It's totally just some new, very new stuff in Southern California.
In your reporting, Mona, you point to some celebrities who are getting involved in the scene as well. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Okay, so here's the latest one that I know about. It's called Monica's House. Some of the celebrities that are involved in this dispensary are actor Woody Harrelson and HBO real-time host Bill Maher. And this place will open up in the summer. It's owned by a group that's been trying to get their consumption lounge off the ground for at least 3 years now, only to have it stopped by COVID. But it's going to be a gorgeous place to ingest cannabis. It's, again, on Santa Monica Boulevard, and this time east of La Cienega, where there's a gorgeous garden in the back. It's supposed to be a place where you can, be happy amongst a beautiful setting. Jay-Z also is very much involved in not necessarily a consumption lounge, but his parent company bought a dispensary called Calma. And once again, this is also in WeHo. It steps away from the original cannabis cafe, and his brand is also sold on site. So there's quite a few celebrities that are trying to get in here, including some that are forthcoming that I'll be able to talk about in a later time.
What is it about WeHo, Mona, that, I mean, did they just one day, they were like, hey, we want to be the cannabis consumption capital of California? I'm doing some alliteration here.
Well, West Hollywood officials were very smart when California voters decided to make adult use legal in 2017. They started making a long-term plan to handle cannabis throughout their own city, which has a longstanding history with cannabis, thanks to making sure that AIDS patients in the 80s and 90s were well looked after during some of the hardest times. And so they launched a permit process and a plan to have dispensaries and consumption lounges all within West Hollywood. And so it was very strategic, and it was incredibly smart, because at the end of this, when all of these consumption lounges, 16 of them, I might add, West Hollywood will be the most unique in the country and, of course, within the state, with places where people can actually go to either take it in, buy smoke, or, of course, edibles, or however way that they prefer.
What about other parts of L.A.? Are other cities getting in on it?
You know, that is the big question. It's a little troubling. Even though cannabis is technically legal in the state, adult use cannabis, it's really hard to find places to consume it outside of your home. And if you live in an apartment, there are a high level of restrictions on what you can do inside that apartment. So I do believe that consumption lounges will actually be a benefit for those who want to partake. But Los Angeles doesn't have a plan as of right now to make that a reality. I know that there are some places in San Francisco and the Bay Area, but West Hollywood is very unique in trying to make sure that it can accommodate these folks who enjoy cannabis. I do know that Palm Springs also has a consumption lounge, but not nearly at the same level or volume of West Hollywood.
Mona Holmes, reporter at Eater LA, of course, one of our regulars here on Greater LA. Mona, as always, great talking to you.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, that's going to do it for us today. Next week, gray whales that migrate past the SoCal coast are getting sick for some reason. We're going to go along on a whale count. the business of cutting all types of hair, and a visit to a pottery shop, wheel and kiln and all, where the formerly incarcerated are crafting new lives. It's all next week on Greater LA. I hope you'll join us. We're online, of course, at the website anytime at kcrw.com/GLA. What stories would you like to hear? What's on your mind? You can get the podcast, too, while you're there at kcrw.com/GreaterLA or, for short, GLA. At our website, and of course, you can grab the podcast wherever you get your podcast. Just look for KCRW Greater LA. Got it? I hope so. Jenna Cagle, Andrea Bautista, Nihar Patel, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Tom, Mike Vogel, and Christian Bordahl all made this evening's show happen. I'm Steve Chitakis. Thanks for your time and your attention, and of course, your ears. Have a great night.